Hopefully this will be coherent for you. Just 3 weeks away. We have an important occasion. Happens every year. Seems like it always comes on us sooner than we were expecting. But it's the occasion of the Passover. We have an important season of the year coming upon us. One that is more important than perhaps we realize after many, many years of observing the Passover. It can become routine. Hopefully we can break out of that today. I'd like to present to you Passover from a broader overview. Because there's been many different ways of observing this occasion. God didn't reveal everything all at once. And I would say that probably accounts for why Passover was observed differently depending on when and where. How long has there been a Passover observance? I remember hearing a minister of our persuasion who mentioned that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob kept the Passover. And I thought that was interesting because it was long before the time of Moses. Wasn't Passover introduced to the Israelites while they were in bondage in Egypt? And it's an interesting question. Now, there is a passage in Scripture. It's found in Genesis chapter 14 and 15. That might fill us in a little bit on that consideration. I'm going to start in chapter 14 about verse 18. Genesis 14. And this is the occasion when a unified force came down from the north and took the cities of the plain, which was where Lot was living at the time. And which included the city of Sodom. Now, Abraham had been living in this area for some time when this happened. Abraham raised an army from his own servants, quite a force. And he went up and he got back the spoils and the hostages that were taken by this invading force. And he came back into the region, and he met with the priest of the Most High God, Melchizedek. Verse 18 says, let's start in 17. And the king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from the slaughter of Chedorlaomer, and of the kings that were with him at the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's dale. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. And he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth." That's an interesting greeting. "And blessed be the Most High God, which has delivered your enemies into your hand. And he gave him tithes of all." Now, we don't know exactly when that was, except there's an important clue, because you see, the next night, there was another holy occasion. After this event, after Abraham tithed, he met with the Lord. Chapter 15. "After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am your shield and your exceeding great reward." Now notice what was on Abram's mind at the time. Abram said, "Lord God, what will you give me, seeing that I go childless? And the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus." And Abram said, "Behold, to me you have given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is mine heir." Abraham had no physical descendants. Why did that matter to this narrative? Well, as we'll see, it was very important. Because for the promises that were being made to Abraham to be fulfilled, he had to have a physical lineage, not just a servant born in his house. Verse 4, and behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, this shall not be your heir, but he that shall come forth out of your own bowels shall be your heir. And he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and tell the stars if you be able to number them. And he said unto him, so shall your seed be. A countless number were going to be the descendants of Abraham. Now we know from the fact that the stars were out what time of day it was. This was after dark. But at this occasion, the Lord gave Abram some instructions. He gave him a special sacrifice to perform. I won't get into the details of that now. I've spoken on other occasions. But this sacrifice was what was the occasion of the confirmation of the promise being made to Abraham. This is what we call the Abrahamic covenant. He set up this special sacrifice the next day. After this occasion, when they were out looking at the stars, the next day he set up this special sacrifice. And he waited all day long. And nothing happened. That afternoon, he had this trance-like thing happen to him, what is called the horror of great darkness. And it's interesting that that would happen to him when you consider what happened many, many generations later. I'll come back to that. But there was this horror of great darkness in the afternoon that came upon Abram. And then the sun went down. Verse 17 of chapter 15. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. This is having to do with the pieces of the sacrifice that Abraham had performed earlier in the day. When the sun went down and it was dark, this was, again, the next evening. And the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying unto you, your seed, have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river Euphrates. This is when the Abrahamic covenant was ratified with this sacrifice. Now what's interesting about this is, if you go to Exodus chapter 12, we're going to see this occasion referenced again. Exodus 12. I think it's 42. Exodus 12, 42. Yes. I'm going to start in verse 40. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass, at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be much observed unto the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. This is that night of the Lord to be observed of all the children of Israel in their generations. 430 years. From what? Well, it was 430 years from that same occasion that we were reading of in Genesis chapter 15. The Exodus took place on the very anniversary of the ratification of the covenant with Abraham. So now we know when that was. That was what is here called the night to be much observed. But this isn't the beginning of that observance. This is calling attention to the memorial of it. This is remembering. This is observing something that had happened 430 years before. So now, knowing that, the bringing forth of bread and wine the night before is interesting. Was that the earliest introduction of the Passover to the peoples of God? I'll leave that with you as a question. I see the good possibility that it was. But notice, it was observed originally, way back in the beginning, simply with bread and wine. Now, did they understand the relevance of the symbology? Very likely they didn't. But at the time of the Exodus, God formally introduced those people to the Passover in a very graphic way. What they understood during that 430 years was not the same thing as they had come to understand more than 400 years later. God added to the Passover. He added points of understanding that was not known previously. Now keep in mind, to know that it was 430 years later, somebody had to have been keeping track. Somebody had to have been observing this occasion. Not saying that the whole world did. Maybe it was just these few who God was working with. Abraham and his direct heirs of the promise. But I'm suggesting that the Passover was introduced much earlier than we might have thought. But when it was formally introduced to the whole nation, that's when things got very interesting and very informative, because more factors were brought into the picture that were not there previously. The Passover, as it was observed at the time of the Exodus, involved the slaying of a lamb. He added different elements. And that lamb had some important symbology to it. That lamb effectively saved their lives. Without that lamb, and without its blood being applied in the prescribed manner, they would not have survived. They would have lost their firstborn. And it's the firstborn who is the focus of this time. The firstborn was representative of the first fruits of God being called into the God family. But that wasn't understood necessarily all that early. We understand things today that they didn't understand. And we'll see that Passover being introduced to the God's people the way it was an ongoing process of revelation. We know things today that they never would have thought of. The New Testament Passover is even more interesting because it adds a lot more elements. But we'll get to that in a minute here. Back to Genesis chapter 15, verse 12. I should have touched on this earlier. Now that we know when this was, this particular vision takes on a relevance that we might not have seen otherwise. 15:12. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. This is late in the afternoon. He'd been waiting all afternoon. And lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. Now knowing what day that was, we can understand that this horror of great darkness was a premonition of Abraham of the death of Jesus Christ at approximately that same time of day. But I'm sure Abram that early didn't understand what we understand today. In Exodus chapter 12, let's go back there. We'll be reading a lot from that area. Exodus chapter 12. We learn some things about Passover. Number one, I guess we could say, is not strictly Jewish. However, there were certain requirements for anyone to have observed it. It wasn't just the ethnicity. That ethnic race had to meet certain criteria before they could keep the Passover. But in Exodus 12:24, we learn that this is something that shall be observed, it says, forever. And you shall observe this thing for an ordinance to you and to your sons forever. This was not a one-time occasion. The way that they kept it only one time. There was only one time where they put the blood over the doorposts. They didn't need to do that in the 40 years in the wilderness. They didn't need to do that when they came into the land. So the observance changed a little bit. But then when we get into the New Testament era, it becomes a whole different picture. In 1 Corinthians 15, well, let me back up a little bit here. I'm getting ahead of myself. Something else we need to notice in introducing the Passover to the people in Egypt. Notice that Pentecost wasn't mentioned. You can read those instructions, and they're given in more than one place. And it might seem odd that the way that they're introduced to the Passover seems to be out of chronological order, and there seems to be multiple mentions, multiple givings of instructions as to how to keep it. It's important to realize that the early books of the New Testament, the Mosaic books we could call them, are compilations. They're not all written by one single author. I'm sure Moses had a lot to do with it. But there are what are called the priestly sections, there are what are called the J sections, and there are what are called the E sections, and those are the places where the writer used Elohim for the name of God in many places, and another one used Yahweh. So we can see that these were compilations put together. So don't look to those passages necessarily as being chronological. They're not always. And the instructions are brought into the picture from multiple sources. Just something to be aware about these passages in the books of first four books of the Old Testament. But in introducing the Passover, he didn't mention Pentecost, not at first. They became aware of that later. Their orientation in observing Passover was historic. When they observed the Passover, they were thinking of the events that were past. Its future application wasn't that obvious. It wasn't known to them the way it is to us today. We realize that the Passover is historic as well as prophetic. They looked at Passover in the context of the event of escaping Egypt, which it was for them. Egypt represented a culture or a lifestyle that we would call living in the culture of sin. That much they did understand. But leaving Egypt's culture did nothing for them with respect to changing their sinful condition. They physically walked out of Egypt, but it didn't change their nature. You see, there was another component to Passover that they didn't understand at first. Leaving Egypt didn't convert anybody. Another thing we can notice from the early narratives is that Passover was closely connected with the days of unleavened bread. The two are mentioned together in many places. They're related to one another. What did that mean to them? What did unleavened bread mean to them? We know what it means to us, but did they understand the same thing? What did unleavened bread mean to them? They saw it in its historic context. They ate leavened bread of necessity because they were on the road leaving the region of Egypt. They didn't have time to prepare food as they normally would have. That's its historic perspective. But we've come to understand another component, another aspect of this, that unleavened bread represents the righteousness of Jesus Christ that we are to take into ourselves. Not only leaving the culture of sin, which is what putting leavened bread away represents, but we're also to take in a nature that we don't normally have, the nature of Jesus Christ. We get that from the days of unleavened bread. In Exodus 12, Moses instructed the people about Passover, but not the days of unleavened bread at that occasion. It's later that the days of unleavened bread were entered into the picture. Those 7 days represented one completed lifetime. One complete lifetime of remaining escaped from the bondage of sin. Unleavenedness represents taking on a new nature, one that we don't naturally have. Did those in the Exodus realize that? And I would say, unlikely, they probably didn't. God was revealing all of this step by step, gradually, to his people. Why couldn't they just have unleavened bread without Passover? And notice there was no wave sheaf before the first Passover in Egypt. They were gone before the wave sheaf day would have come. They didn't have fields to harvest for a wave sheaf offering at that time. The wave sheaf offering was first offered after they had a crop that they had planted in the land. There was a prerequisite, and it's found in Exodus 23:16. To offering a wave sheaf offering, it couldn't be from just anywhere. You couldn't go down to the market and buy a sheaf of grain and offer it. That isn't how it was done. Exodus 23:16, and the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors, which you have sown in the field, and the feast of ingathering, which is in the end of the year, when you have labored in your labors out of the field. It was important that it be produce that they themselves had grown with their own efforts. That too was important. It had to be theirs, something of theirs. Joshua 4:19 is another place I want to look at, because this is the Passover occasion after the end of the Exodus. Up to this point, we've been considering it beforehand. But 4:19, Joshua 4:19. And notice, this too is interesting. And the people came up out of Jordan. This is crossing the river that stopped when the column first stepped on shore. The water backed up and they went across dry shod. And the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped in Gilgal in the east border of Jericho. Down to verse 23, for the Lord your God dried up the waters of Jordan from before you until you were passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea which he dried up from before us until we were gone over. That all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty. That you might fear the Lord your God forever. This was the 10th day of the first month. This was just before the Passover. Now later on that same day, they began doing something that we would cringe at if it were our circumstance, I'm sure. But they rededicated themselves. They were going to keep the Passover for their second time. There's no record that they kept the holy days while they were during the Exodus. But this we know, this is the first occasion when they kept the Passover after the end of the Exodus. They rededicated themselves to the covenant by undergoing circumcision on the 10th. They rededicated themselves. They made themselves ready for the Passover because there was a pre-requirement that no one who was uncircumcised should keep the Passover. That's stated very clearly. I'm making the point that this, you know, you have to wonder how they did so without the rededication of themselves through circumcision, because they didn't perform circumcisions while they were during the 40 years in the wilderness. There's a scripture that positively states that. I don't have it here in front of me. But let's get the point here that it was important that they meet certain criteria in order to be able to keep this Passover. Now, approximately a third of the population was old enough to be of that generation that lived in Egypt. But more than half of the people were born during the 40 years in the wilderness. Those are the people that had to rededicate themselves in order to be able, in accordance with God's instructions, to keep the Passover. It was on the 10th day. Well, what else happened on the 10th day? The 10th day was the day that they selected their paschal lambs. So there was a correlation. And they kept the Passover just a few days later. And it says in Joshua chapter 5, I believe it is, I'm going to start in verse 2. And at that time the Lord said unto Joshua, make thee sharp knives and circumcise again the children of Israel the second time. And Joshua made him sharp knives and circumcised the children of Israel at the hill of the foreskins. And this is the cause why Joshua did circumcise. All the people that came out of Egypt that were males, even all the men of war, died in the wilderness, by the way, after they came out of Egypt. Now all the people that came out were circumcised. But all the people that were born in the wilderness, by the way, as they came forth out of Egypt, them they had not circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 years in the wilderness till all the people that were men of war, which came out of Egypt, were consumed because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord, unto whom the Lord sware them that he would not show them the land, which the Lord sware unto their fathers, that he would give us a land that flows with milk and honey. So these people were circumcised in order to dedicate themselves to the covenant that God had made with their ancestor Abraham. Verse 10, and the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho. And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the self same day. So we see from that there was a requirement, and that's the point I want to make, that there is a pre-requirement to observing the Passover. It's not just anyone. There are certain pre-requirements. The ones we have today are a little different. But that's the point. That it is a covenant. And it's a covenant that's serious. It's a covenant that has a time commitment to it. And it's a covenant that has a pre-requirement as to who is involved in it. A person must have made that covenant himself. So we see the Passover had a period of development from the earliest days. I'm going to go on the presumption that what we see in Genesis 14 was a precursor of the Passover observance. It was introduced as a covenant observance with bread and wine. We read of that in Genesis 14. A blood sacrifice was added to exempt from death in Exodus 12, 430 years later. And there is both a historic and a prophetic set of considerations. But Jesus Christ changed the Passover even more. In John 13, this occasion is developed out further. More of what it's about was presented to his disciples. This wasn't public, this was to his disciples. John 13. And this is a component in our observance today. In verse 4, he rises from supper and laid aside his garments and took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet. Now, this wasn't before everything. This was during, which tells us this wasn't really necessary on account of them having dirty feet. This was necessary for another reason. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter says unto him, Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus answered and said unto him, what I do, you know not now, but you will know hereafter. He's telling us that we're going to realize things as we meditate on these things afterward, not necessarily at the moment. Peter said unto him, you'll never wash my feet. Jesus answered and said, if I wash you not, you have no part with me. Does that suggest this is important? Simon Peter said unto him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. Jesus said unto him, he that is washed needs not save to wash his feet, but is clean every whit. And you are clean, but not all. Down to verse 13. You call me Master and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. Why? He says, for I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done unto you. Truly I say unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord, neither he that is sent greater than he that sent him. If you know these things, happy are you if you do them. What's the point of foot washing? He, being the master of all, gave us the example that we are to humble ourselves and serve one another. That is a visible expression of his unleavenedness. There are many ways where unleavenedness doesn't show, but there's one that it does. Humble service toward one another. A very important component was added into the picture of the observance of Passover. But that wasn't all, because they were observing a traditional meal at the time. That's how it was done. He changed things, and I'm sure we know what happened. He took two of the elements that were included in that meal, and he gave them a new relevance, a new picture. He took bread, and he took wine. The very things that we read of in Genesis 14. We know the date. We know when this happened. He took bread and wine and gave them a picture. The bread represented his broken body. The wine represented his shed blood. You see, he was our Passover. And that's how our Passover was sacrificed for us, fulfilling the picture that they had had for hundreds of years, ever since the Exodus. Who knows all of what they understood? But we know now what that all pictured. The Lamb of God, our Passover, that takes away the sins of the world. As time goes on, we understand more and more. God didn't reveal it all at once, but he had it in mind all through time. We understand today what the Passover is all about in ways that our spiritual predecessors never did. God is gradual in his revelatory processes. And we know things today that I'm sure worshipers of generations back wished they had known. So we're privileged to know of these things. We're privileged to know of the meaning of these things. So the Passover developed gradually. It was introduced as a covenant observance, with bread and wine, apparently. Then he added a blood sacrifice that exempted the firstborn from death. That was added 430 years later. It was a long time. But then Christ added a humble service component. Our field of considerations must involve the welfare of others. It's not just to save our own hide. That's only part of it. But there's more to it. In Luke 22, 20, we see where we, as his disciples, are brought into the covenant in a particularly meaningful way. Luke 22, verse 20. A simple little passage. He says, likewise also the cup after supper, saying, this cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you. A long time ago, it may be almost 10 years ago, I gave a message on that particular phrase. What people don't understand, and those who are familiar with Jewish culture will understand, but that phrase was borrowed from a formal Jewish marriage proposal. When he extended that cup to them and passed it around and said, I want all of you to drink of this, that was a proposal of marriage. Jesus Christ was proposing marriage to his prospective bride on Passover. And the cup went around the room, and each of them drank of it. Now, when the prospective bride would drink of the cup, she would be, in effect, accepting his proposal of marriage. And then he would take the cup and drink of it himself to accept her acceptance. And an interesting thing happened. When the cup got back to him, and this tells you that they understood the meaning of that phrase. They made the connection. When the cup got back to him, he was expected to drink of it himself. And he held it and he said, I will not drink of it from this point on until I drink it new with you in the kingdom. Now that tells us a number of things. Number one, it says that that observance is going to be observed through time, clear on into the kingdom. But it tells us something else. When he would have drunk of it, that would have closed the proposal. His not drinking of it left the invitation open for people to be added to his prospective bride clear through to the beginning of the kingdom. Call that speculation if you will. It's, to me, I think, obvious. That's why he didn't drink of it. That's why he said what he said. If he had simply drunk of it, there would be no reason to mention that. But the mention is that he did not. And it was for the reason that when that cup is extended to us, it is still open to us to be included in the bride of Christ. And that open door of opportunity to be a part of the bride will remain open until the second coming, until he and his bride get together in the early months of the kingdom. After that, it'll be a different story. But Jesus Christ changed the symbology even more. This was not how it was observed throughout the Old Testament period. He expanded the meaning in very dynamic and exponential ways. He changed the symbols. He changed the dialogue. He changed the presentation. And later we can read in 1 Corinthians 11, I won't take the time to go there, but 1 Corinthians 11, Paul, as a result of some chaos at the observance, discontinued the traditional meal. It was no longer part, or it was no longer necessary under the New Testament to have the traditional meal. He instructed them to simply use the basic elements of the bread and the wine. Back to where it all began. But something else was changed, because it was no longer an ethnic invitation. Prior to that time, the people who were to keep the Passover would be ethnic Jews or proselytes. Paul extended the Passover observance to Gentiles as well. Not just religious Jews. But perhaps the most important thing of all, we can read of that in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 27. Because this too is new. 1 Corinthians 11, 27. And I began by alluding to this, where we can become desensitized by the Passover becoming routine. Paul understood the real purpose of Passover. Not only humility and service, not only symbolic circumcision at least, but something even more important, 1 Corinthians 11, 27. Now you are the body of Christ and members in particular. And God has set some in the church, first apostles, secondary. Am I in the right place? No, I'm in 12. 11, 27. I'm going to back up to verse 24 and get the whole picture here. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. After the same manner also he took the cup when he had supped, saying, this cup is the new testament in my blood. This do you as oft as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you drink this bread and drink this cup, you do show forth the Lord's death till he come. We are to commemorate his death, not his resurrection. Wherefore, whosoever shall eat and this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily shall be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. Paul is introducing something extremely important, that we are to prepare ourselves mentally for the Passover. We are to examine ourselves. And when we do that, I'm sure we're not going to find out that we're perfect and don't need to examine ourselves. That's the person I think needs to worry. But Paul says, but in verse 28, but let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of that bread and drink of that cup. After self-examination, for this cause, many are weak and sickly among you, and many sleep. They become desensitized. For if we would judge ourselves, we should not be judged. So here's the important elements. The new covenant Passover is different. It has evolved. It has changed throughout history. And each time it changes, we understand more of what it's about than we ever did before. What are the lessons of Passover? Let's review them in conclusion here. Number one, that prior preparation must be made. Originally, the lambs were selected on the 10th, and the people were rededicated to the covenant on the 10th day of the month. Secondly, it is life and death important. If they didn't do what they were told, if they didn't do it the way they were told, there was a heavy consequence. Third thing, who may participate in observing the Passover is limited. It's not for everyone. It's for those who are called. It's no longer of the ethnic calling, but of the called family, those who are called according to his kind. Also, the timing is important. We can read in Exodus 12, verse 2, that God reset their clocks. He told them the criteria by which to establish the first month of the year, so that their calendar would be aligned with the proper seasons. And the Passover was sufficiently important to require a second observance for those who, for valid reasons, missed the first occasion. In Numbers chapter 9, verses 9 to 12, he established and he authorized a second Passover. It's that important. There's no other holy day that has that feature to it. The Passover had a historic relevance originally, but it illustrates an important spiritual relevance. Something else we know about the Passover is it is a covenant associated with the original covenant, the very one that promised the Exodus. We learn that there's a blood sacrifice involved. A blood sacrifice that substituted for their own death. That blood sacrifice that we look to is different than the ones that the people in Egypt would have looked to. But we recognize the symbology there. We learn that it is to be observed throughout our generations. The Passover is the fulcrum of all other holy days, at least the spring set. Without Passover, there's no days of unleavened bread. Without the days of unleavened bread, there's no wave sheaf offering. Without the days of unleavened bread and the wave sheaf offering, there's no Feast of Pentecost. We need to consider all of those events as part of an overall picture. We learn that the Passover is important enough to require a recommitment to that covenant that we made every year. God doesn't want us to forget. And we learn that that commitment involves self-examination. That's not something they did in Egypt. Passover presents a marriage proposal to God's elect. And he left open the inclusion period. And from the things we've reviewed today, we realize that Passover will be observed in the kingdom. Passover developed over time. Nationally, it was their escape from physical bondage. But to us, it's our escape from the bondage of sin, both in the culture that we live in and in our own personal selves. Passover illustrates and draws us into our personal relationship with our high priest, our Passover who was slain for us, our relationship with our Savior. Passover is important. It's important to God. It needs to be important to us. It's not just a formal observance, and as we can see, it's one with deep meaning.